Questions from the audience?
Jared, I know you do a lot of visual work.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is there a relationship between the visual work, like the work that you read, and the visual work of which you've been doing a lot lately? Yeah. Actually, you know what? I'm asking you that question. I switched that question over for the second part to you because same is true.
I wish I had a good answer. I'm not sure. I don't know how to put them together. I tend to think of them as being pretty separate and trying to work separate parts of my brain.
There are words in some of the visual, right?
Yeah. There's definitely words and writing that are involved. It's that kind of sense of it comes out of a. Usually, when I'm doing artwork, most of the time it's a. It either stems from an engagement with some kind of material technique, or I'm working in collaboration. So, for instance, I did this set of poems that were based on notary seals, and then that meant that those poems were became oaths. So I researched the history and the form of the oath, and thought about the oath as a kind of interaction between a speech act and a poem, and whether an oath could be a form for poetry that could consider the question of efficacy or doing something in a poem. And then I did another thing like that with curses and maledictions and benedictions. But I tend to want to have the poems to be able to operate on their own terms. And so they're kind of like, they feel weirdly more private and mine than doing the artwork in some way, just because it exists in space in a different way. This is not a good answer, but some of that is part of it.
For me, so primarily I work as a photographer, not in collaboration in the way that you do, and they don't relate in terms of the structure, but they relate dispositionally. They are the result of the same kind of obsessive rigor. So in both cases, I
could say that too.
Yeah, the same formal concerns that then move into formal concerns with abstraction, the relationship between abstraction and more figurative work, and so to speak, and those are at play in both my work as a writer and my work as a photographer.
So this is a kind of little bit of a follow-up question for both of you. I guess it's a little bit two parts, although there's some danger here since I haven't thought it through. but there's a certain physicality, there's a practice to both of what you do that I'm pretty familiar in both cases. So there's a physicality to the work, and there's a, I see you in your studio, you got all this crap all over the place, so you're doing, and there's some, it's not like you're in a dark room, but you're manipulating the image and stuff, and there's a lot of process. And then, Jared, for you, there's that, obviously, but also I think there's a conceptuality and a performance aspect, mm-hmm. right? There's going out to sites, doing stuff that nobody sees, coming back,
right.
taking pictures of it,
guess.
So, so I guess there's the question of when you're doing that stuff, do you think of lines, and does that generate work? Or is it simply the concerns that are just similar that generates?
Right? Sure.
Well, I don't, Jared, I think your visual work is enmeshed with a kind of language practice, which it isn't for me. And so it doesn't generate lines for me. It's totally, it just comes out of these similar approaches. And in fact, one of the things that is useful to me about having both practices is that each one is an escape from the other one.
Yeah.
A liberation from the other when it feels on top of me. So, yeah.
I thought of a better answer to your first question, which responds to this as well. Spatiality is the thing that ties all of my work together, I think. Moving through space, working that way. And the current project I'm working on with with an artist, a sculptor in Toronto is about making museums, about making an artist. We're making an artist museum, and so it's pretty conceptual. And the source material on my end is thinking about signage. I'm really interested in signage as a form. I used to take a fair amount of cultural geography courses, and we talk about a freeway as a monomic landscape, a single-use landscape, and that requires all the signage and language in order to make it work properly. And so I got interested in museums and their relationship to the way that signage affects the way we look at artwork or move through the space. I got interested in that in its relationship to moving through a poem, you know. So I started to think about poems as collections or little museums, actually like museums of lines. But that was more of an importation of a visual art kind of context onto the poems. It didn't kind of go the other way. And my general interest in visual art really just kind of started when I was in graduate school and just super frustrated by literary theory or theories of poetic practice. I was much interested in hearing artists talk about this for whatever reason. I'm not sure what that was ultimately, except that it just seemed more embodied and spatialized, essentially. And so, even though I'm working with text almost always when I'm working with artists, I will come on as the writer or something. And more now I'm doing more things on my own. It's because I'm just very curious about how language kind of enforces rules in space and whether you can use those kind of rhetorics against their intended purpose. It's an interesting thing, just the way that the degree to which we talk about that age old question of like poetry and efficacy and use. And then there's this other part of language that people obey, unthinkingly, because of its typographic and vocabulary and the way that it's used in space. So,
well, that's similar really interesting. It's similar to the oath or the curse, because I've had interest in those forms as well. These are things that they have an impact.
Yeah.
If I say 5 to 10 and Sing Sing, then that's a sentence that really has. So thank you.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned poetry and efficacy and use.
Yeah.
And I come from a family of impatient, aggressive, anti-intellectualists.
And, me too.
I was just thinking, in explaining my own, decision to be an artist to them, it's frustrating to explain that it's kind of a compulsion. And so I guess what my question would be, and please don't take this the wrong way, is that if you were speaking to someone of that kind of sort of background, and they were just to say to you, what's the point in thinking about your own work? Maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
If I was Steve, I would say, what's the point? I don't know. Maybe I'll let you speak for yourself.
Well, I suppose I would... The first thing, I think many of us come from families not dissimilar to the one you're describing. Many of us here. It's not a meaningful question What's the point is not a meaningful question. It's not, it actually doesn't refer to anything. Like, it's literally a sentence that has no reference point in the world. And the point is always the point. So describing the point has to do with, you know, say, your artistic practice has perhaps begins with the way in which it refigures or transfigures your experience of the world. That doesn't mean it's does this, you know, I'm not, these practices are public for us, but they start private. And even when we conceive of them as essentially public, because they're in language, we're writing against or towards a literary tradition or an artistic tradition or what have you. We imagine the ways in which they might be received, and we imagine this ideal reader, right? The ideal reader is, of course, not the person who's asking you, what's the point? It's not your job to tell them what the point is, you know? So my answer to what the point is fuck you.
Mine is more of a shrug.
That's a lot of the difference between us.
Yeah, that's right.
In
yeah.
our friendship.
I always liked it when Robert Duncan would talk about, he said something like, I write poetry for the same reason a general wages war, to exercise my faculties at large. Just like, well, yeah. It's an equivalency.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, motion in your guys' work, one not moving, one seeming to move a lot. Of course, like, the language is always moving, but maybe you guys could address that.
There is, for me, the abiding impulse in my work is to attempt a kind of, I'm trying to resolve the world, right? It's a system. It's a philosophical system. So it's looking for stasis that transcends space and time, and it's constantly recognizing that yields paradox over and over again. So any motion is all the motion that is possible. In situ, as you know, the narrator finds, or the main character finds himself struck by an imbalance, and he falls over, essentially. So 200 pages later, spoiler for those of you who are reading it for your class.
That's what happens.
That's finally, he is unsuccessful in preventing his head from hitting the ground and his body from making a kind of triangle, right? That's all the motion in the universe. You know, any movement at all is too much movement for him. Any movement means that the stasis that he's seeking, which is the transcendence that he's seeking, the transcendence of death, the transcendence of body, that all of the ways in which he's hoping to transcend a world which is incalculably and ineluctably paradoxical, fails him. But that failure is, of course, paradoxically a necessary failure. It's a completion of a different kind of system. So,
I'm tactical and improv. I'm much more interested in improvisation as it has to do with moving through the world. And I don't know what else to really say about that. I'm much more interested in that kind of the excitement and the friction of motion as it proceeds, and to see if a poem can kind of be built out of a series of these kind of swerving motions through the world. I'm not interested in a systematic set of decisions, even though those inevitably there's repetitions. Andrew and I were talking I never realized how much truck exhaust was in the poems until I read them today. I was like, there's a lot of exhaust. Yeah, I'm trying not to write super systematically and just thinking about, it's just not a system. I don't think of it as systematic. I think of it as just kind of almost a series of negotiations and tactics.
Did someone curate this? I felt like it was curated. You guys.
It's coming together?
Is it just...
You mean
so
as...
opposite.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
These things happen, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we are. We're sort of strangely opposite and strangely close.
Yeah.
And we kind of...
It's funny when we get come to the end of a... come to an impasse in conversation, it just kind of goes... Which happens, and I think that's great. Yeah. I think it was there's a hand back there.
This may be a little redundant, but can you walk us, both of you, through the creative process between, like, kind of compare and contrast your creative process between, like, writing your poetry versus reading your poetry? Because I've gone to, like, poetry readings and I interpreted poetry different based off how the poet was reading their own work. Yeah. Does that question make sense?
Sort of thinking about the difference between the process of composing it at home and then performing it. Yeah,
because you said you're kind of like improv.
I mean, I just you know, I don't know. I'm really trying to dance with my poems. You know, there's a degree of off kilter music you can work in your poems, and just they kind of, I don't know. I don't really write them other than have a sense of their percussive effect on my body, you know, and having a sense of like I'm doing right now, I start to want to touch parts of my body I'm talking about in the poem, you know, and that's that happens during the writing process as well. So as I'm composing it, I'll start doing that, and it's. I don't know. It's sort of embarrassingly exciting for me personally, but I don't know how it comes off. It seems a little exhibitionist.
Well, I will say that I do compose with, I don't know if I would say with performance in mind, but I always am doing things out loud. I'm always reading it out loud at every moment and every revision and then the preparation for performing the work is, at least when it's work, as opposed to individual poems or something like that, when it's from a longer text, I rehearse a lot. You know, I treat it like a performance. I think of it like a performance. I want to know where I'm putting stress and where I'm not. Mm. And I want that to be fairly seamless. And I take, enormous pleasure in it. I really love doing it. So it feels embarrassing.
It's really fun.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
So we've talked about how great it would be if we could have a podcast or something like that of all of C2. And right. I could play it in the car for hours. And you weren't against that idea, as I recall. Yeah. So one of the reasons that you weren't against it, if I understand correctly, is that you are very interested, as you said, in hearing it and in the lyric nature of it. Could you talk a little bit about how you see and hear lyric operating in the work?
I mean, for me, it's, you know, often quite metered. And I think that it's a challenge with work that isn't lineated for people. When they approach it, they don't necessarily think of reading it out loud, to hearing the stress in a way that actually reveals metrical elements in the work. I would say even it relates to also to what you were asking, Brett, in the sense that the way in which the meter drives the work as the first lyric element in the work is the first and most important intrusion of embodiment into the work, and the way in which the work itself is embodied, and this figure can be thinking, it can be saying or understanding something in such an arcane and circuitous way that I think is, it doesn't matter if it's unpacked, if its meaning is unpacked. The first thing that happens is it's music. And then you can it can be figured out or not or whatever, and I don't even care about that. I just want, it's an excuse for making that music. If that answers, yeah.
Hi, I wanted to ask about your process of writing, meaning both of you guys performed long pieces. I'm not sure if they were small pieces that you guys read together, but for the longer pieces, I was wondering if you have a concept of what you're gonna, how the poem's gonna end, or do you do them in pieces? I just wanted to know the process of longer poems and how you approach them.
That first bit that I read was I think 5 poems just strung together, but one of the ones in there is a really long poem. And yeah, I feel like the main thing that happens, or at least I did with the long poems in my last book, was trying to find a rhythm and then just using that rhythm throughout it. I don't know how that it happened, but I think that one like arbitrarily had 10 syllable lines. I'm not sure why, there's no reason, just to keep it going. And and then it just kind of built steadily from there. And that poem went through a bunch of revision phases. It actually appeared first in a under a different title. It's called Abundance, and it appeared in Steve's magazine Palach under the title Opening Day, which I was stupid. I mean, I love baseball, but I'm not going to write a poem called that. And which it's also been done, but. So it was originally like arbitrarily split into 13 line sections for some reason that I don't really know. It was totally arbitrary. I eventually put it together in a single stanza. And then, it was composed over, I think, 8 months or something like that. Just that was the only thing I worked on. And I realized that the beginning was not working really well. And so I was on GChat with a poet friend of mine, and I said, I really need a figure for something that looks really good while it's blowing up. And he said, well, what about like fire, when you shoot fireworks in a tree and it catches on fire? And I was like, great. So that was the beginning of the poem. And then I was able to sort of build up a series of images for the first page of that poem based on that. It ended up having like I think 7 or 8 hands in the composition process where I'd say, is this working? And it's like, no, this is not working. This, and this. So it was kind of, it takes a long time, but I feel like a long poem like that, especially, like it's really fun to kind of show it to people at a certain point because you can say, well, I think that's the only reason I realized that initial draft wasn't working. I showed it to someone, they're just like, this beginning is really boring and it's not very spiky. And so I needed to figure that out. Yeah.
So this piece that what I was reading from is a long. It's just a single piece. It's a long book that is a kind of hybrid prose poetry, and it takes a very long time. I mean, I've been working on it for 10 years, and over that time, you know, many different processes, many other things come and go, other things I finish that I've also been working on for 10 years or what have you. You know, what it does start with sound, and then it moves to other concerns that are philosophical or are discursive in a set of traditions that I see the work participating in, poetic, novelistic, and philosophical traditions. And so, you know, it's this, I am never writing without reading, and so whatever I'm reading is always going into the work over and over again. And when I come back to it the 500th time, whatever I just read yesterday might enter the work. So the finish point is a point of, it's a point of polish that could continue forever. So, it's really a point of abandonment. At some point, I'm done because I'm done, you know.
Do you revise after reading, like a reading like this?
You mean if I'm reading work that isn't in print or even work that is in print?
Yeah.
By the time it gets to being in print, I always know how it will sound out loud because that's how I'm writing it. So that doesn't happen. I mean, it essentially doesn't happen. I might think something doesn't work. I don't know. I don't know how you tell if that's happening or not. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I read some lines that I'm definitely going to cut. I was like, no, this is not going to work. Yeah. So that's a good thing to figure out. Hopefully there are not too many of those in a reading.
Yeah. But you read from your book, from years.
Yeah, there's parts that I've had to edit from that.
When
I'm
you
not
going
to say what they
when
are.
When you do readings. Yeah. Knowing that they are permanently there.
I mean,
if there's a second edition, what have you, you can make a change.
No, right.
In the eighth edition.
Marianne Moore problem.
Thank you. Maybe I have another question. Sorry. So when you write your poems, how do you do you start from beginning to end, or how do you know how to order your poems?
In a work that is of different poems,
yes.
Say?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that?
Yeah.
Did you know the end of Situ when you started writing it?
Well, I didn't, but I also wrote maybe, you know, five times as much on paper before, you know, then that got cut and rewrote everything. But that has a kind of an obvious movement. One thing follows from the last. It's different when you're ordering poems or other work where the next piece doesn't essentially follow from the last piece. And is that what you're asking about? Yeah. And for me, I guess, sometimes that's not clear to me, but understanding the ways in which I guess I go back to this notion of what it would be to read it, what it would be to hear it, in its order, in the sort of consecution that you lay it out in. So, but
endings are very hard. There was a review of my first book that said that I didn't know how to end my poems, and I took that very seriously. just because I was like, maybe that's true. So I like worked on that a lot in my second book, and but. Yeah, because I think early on I was sort of opposed to the idea of having a poem in, which is very like super pretentious thing to say, and to think. I really had to. There are just certain ways of ending poems that are super hack, and I was taking the negative route, where I was like, I'm not going to end it this way. because I hate a poem that ends in a really disappointing, you know, I mean, we can list the many ways that a poem that ends badly. So generally in my second book, I just started writing them backwards, and then I would write from the ending forward and try to write toward a point. And then the third one, I didn't worry about it very much. But it is something. It's like very pleasurable to just, you know, write poems backwards. It just seems like it gives you a real, it gives you a real sculptural sense of how a poem operates if you do that, or a sense of its arbitrariness, or, you know, as a revision process, it's real, real fun to do. I think. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. I was thinking, Steve, in situ, the work you read, I get the sense like each stanza, paragraph, like begins as if from the same position. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a starting point that is returned to each time. And I'm wondering if you agree with that, but also if this is something that you feel carries over in your other work as well, in your other writings that you do.
Yes, to the second part of that question. I think there is a kind of progress of conceptual elements through the book, so that, but the position point of the narrator come character are roughly start over each time, as you're saying. For me, I think that I am one of those people who is writing the same book over and over mm-hmm. again, and I feel happy about that. I mean, it's the same. It's not the same work, of course, because it moves slightly and it shifts in different directions and it does different things for me, and different things. I think it construes a different reader. So in a way, that's even true with each stanza. That each stanza contrives a different recipient, and pushes a different potential recipient into the world. Even as the narrative position is another refraction from the same point.
If that answers. So you're creating your reader.
Yes, mm-hmm. I think so. I think we all are. I think we don't have any choice, but that. And that creating a reader who will then create a text that is entirely not mine. So, ideally.
I don't agree with that at all. This would be a point of disagreement.
Yeah.
What's that?
Say more of that.
Well, I guess I'm interested in a process of meeting a reader, or a sense of potentiality in the reader. It's just so wonderful to meet readers of poetry. It's added wonder if they're interested in one's own work, obviously. But I'm interested in the sort of extending of the hand very much as a writer, not from any sort of. I don't know. I think I'm just interested in like a sort of a relinquishing of control on a certain level as a writer, and I think that's an exciting.
I'm not disagreeing with that. Yeah. In fact, I'm totally interested in relinquishing control.
I know that.
on every conceivable level, but the.
I tend to. I mean, you guys are talking in terms of creation, and I'm like. I don't understand what that word means. Maybe is the thing. I almost don't even think of myself as a creative writer, honestly. Mm-hmm. In that sense, not even maybe a creator of occasions, but yeah. Beyond that.
Well, I mean, the two
givenness of other people is kind of an exciting part of it for me very much.
Me too. But I mean, there are, the position points I reference are Kierkegaard, who is thinking like, "What the fuck? I'm writing this shit, and there's no way, and there is no possible reader for this, but there will be." Right, and so that's one position that we all have. We don't know who the reader is, and the work can't. The other position is the Mandelstam position in his essay. It's called "On the Interlocutor." If you ever have a chance to take a look, and he's saying, "Look, I'm not. You should not think you know who your reader is, and don't write towards them. If you do, you undermine the possibilities of poetic condensation that are in your work." You're writing towards an opening, and that opening will be filled in some way that you can't predict, which is why he's making an argument against something that's very popular now, against coterie and talking about your friends in your poems. Mm. He's saying, don't talk about your friends in your poems, which, you know, now is like somehow there are classes on how to do that, I think. But
have you banned people from talking about you in poems?
No,
I have.
I don't mind.
At least certain people have mentioned me more than once. I'm like, no more.
Yeah, as long as they don't think it's actually me.
No. I don't even want the illusion of myself in.
Maybe one more question. Mm.
Stanley.
Yeah.
So
George.
I think,
George
and Stanley. You could do it. Tell me, getting away with things. There was a moment in one of the poems where you said nope at a particular time.
Mm-hmm, nope, yeah.
And there were many other moments where it was like, this means that you'd have to be like trying to get away from something and whether you care about that something. But it seems like you got away with a lot, or you're trying to get away with a lot.
I was trying to get away with a lot in the sense of presenting a claim and like qualifying it and backing off it.
Strange material, funny material, strange objects, strange images, funny images, non sequiturs, things coming in, floating in and out.
Meh. Garbage.
I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm asking about the composition when you're composing and how you're thinking about that. It's a better question.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea that, like, you could, you know, you
like truck exhaust.
Yeah, you know? Truck exhaust, yeah. I mean, that's pretty real to me. Because, yeah. I just ride my bike a lot, and so I just breathe it constantly. But I like the idea. I wrote this book, Ears, with the idea that I would decide to just very consciously use the sort of I-thou lyric position. And it's the first book I wrote that's just all lineated verses, no mixtures of prose and stuff in there. And because I got very interested in the idea of kind of the idea of the genre of hybrid writing that presented itself as combinations of lyric and prose writing, etc. So I just wanted to write, I ended up wanting to see if I could just do something that looked superficially like lyric writing that just had just everything in the kitchen sink thrown into it. If that sort of basic I-thou construction could hold as much stuff as it, how much could it hold was sort of the question I was interested in. And to see if I could kind of come up with a way, an interaction between sentence and line that could get a lot of just noise and junk and garbage into the poem. Because I did want to see how much you could get away with just the basic, that simple formula, which is that's one of the simplest building blocks in poetry. So it was very much like, oh, let's just, you know, today this is going on, so let's like throw it in and see what can work. But there was a fair amount of culling. And then sometimes, you know, this musician, Captain Beefheart, he was doing drum tracks for the drummer in the band. And the way that he was composing drum tracks was he would go to the to a train crossing and wait for the train. And he had these little cassette recorders and wait for the train and then turn on the windshield wipers in the car and then press record. And then he would give that tape to the drummer. And that like level of concrete decision making is like that's very exciting and fundamental to my process of like bringing the world into the work, because it was just kind of it's totally arbitrary, and I have never heard this tape. This is kind of an anecdotal story, but that the process of having the drummer have to decide on a rhythm that's based on this totally arbitrary external pattern, that's two patterns working against one another. It's like very exciting to me. And that's like something I tend to want to use as a principle in finding things to put in the poems, you know. You just feel, I don't know, I personally just feel like a nerve, you know, and I just am like, what's gonna fit into this, you know? Because, I don't know, you know, this sense that like you could make a lyric poem hold all this stuff was just so amusing to me. Yeah, I'm gonna spin out now, but truck exhaust.
Thank you both.
Thanks. Did you like that?